From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and here's what America's being offered Sunday night.
On September 11th, our bravest heroes rose to their greatest challenge and saved thousands.
When the road gets dark.
This is their story as it's never been told.
And you can no longer see.
Witness the only footage from inside Ground Zero.
Have a little faith in me.
Robert De Niro hosts 9/11, Sunday on CBS. Presented by Nextel with limited interruptions.
The CBS special captures the entire World Trade Center disaster and includes never-before-seen footage of evacuation chaos inside the North Tower. The networks call the special a powerful and historic work. Some of the family's victims call it devastating and offensive and say that 6 months after the terrorist attacks is too soon. In this hour, how do private pain and the public's right to see and know coexist in the media age? We begin tonight's discussion with Jules Naudet, who along with his brother shot the stunning footage featured in the CBS program, and with James Hanlon, a New York City firefighter and co-producer. On the morning of 9/11, Jules was 14 blocks from the World Trade Center. Earlier, I asked him what he'd been working on that day.
We had been working, our best friend James Hanlon and my brother and I had been working for a documentary on firefighters for the past 4 months. We had been filming in James' firehouse, which is right close to the World Trade Center. And on that morning, a call had came in at about 8:30 for an apparent gas leak at the street corner, a few blocks away from the firehouse. And as we were, as the chief were wrapping things up, we heard that very loud roar coming from above us. Had time just to look up. I turned my camera towards where the plane was going, and it suddenly crashed into the first tower.
Your film had been intended to be about the camaraderie of the firehouse and the routines there. It turned into something quite different that day.
Definitely. Well, it was from the beginning. It was to be about the 9 months probationary period of a rookie firefighter, what we called a probie. And we had filmed throughout the entire summer. But that film, even though it became different, is still it's not only 9/11. We didn't want it to be just that. We wanted to show what these guys are doing, what is the camaraderie and the family-like tradition that it is.
We've incorporated the first part of the summer that we filmed into the program. You'll see through the probie's eyes what it's like to come onto the job and inside that inner circle of the fire department.
A circle that you know well, James Hanlon. And then, Jules Naudet, there was the sudden surprise. What did you first perceive had happened? How did you respond?
Well, immediately when the plane went into the tower, I guess like everybody, it was like, am I dreaming? Is this happening?
Were you outside at that time, Jules? Did you see it? How did you know that the plane was coming? Exactly what happened?
Well, I was filming the chief, and we're outside in the street corner, a few mm-hmm. blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we hear this roar, so we look up, see the plane, it disappears behind a building, so I turn my camera to know when it's going to come out on from the other side, where is it going to go, and it crashes directly into the North Tower, and my first reaction was disbelief, I couldn't believe it, and then, of course, my God, an horrible accident has just taken place, and before I had time to think about anything else, the firefighters rushed to their trucks and left immediately for the building.
How did you get to the Trade Center? You did go to the Trade Center that day, on the truck or by foot?
Actually, no. I jumped into the battalion car, as I normally ride with, and arrived at the same time as they did.
Tell us where your camera took you on that morning.
Well, I remember we arrived, we parked the normal place where Engine 7, Ladder 1, Battalion 1 park, which is right under the awning of 1 World Trade Center. And as we arrived, we saw that the damage in the lobby was extensive, and the windows are being blown out, the people were on fire, and we realized later on that it was the jet fuel that came down the elevator shaft and created a fireball in the lobby. And as we entered the lobby, I remember seeing two people on fire on my right. I remember glancing at them and deciding right here, there is no way I'm going to film anything like this.
That was an important decision. You made a decision not to shoot everything you saw that day. What didn't you shoot, and why?
Well, I didn't want to. This first encounter with these people were burning on the side. I thought it was personally it was so a horrible image that I still have to my mind still now that I didn't think people should see this or would want to see this.
How long did you stay in the tower and its vicinity, and what did you shoot?
We arrived in the lobby. I filmed nonstop. Until I would say both tower comes down without stopping. It came at first in the lobby, then the second plane hits. I'm still in the lobby filming the firefighters do what they do best, which is responding to a crisis. I remember seeing firefighters going up the stairs to get people out, to rescue people.
When did you get out and why?
When the south tower collapsed, we heard that roar. We believed that our tower was coming down on top of us and had time to run across, turn the corner in the lobby, which leads into a room which is in 6 World Trade Center, and waited, I guess, for what we thought was going to be our death. And after a few seconds, realized, okay, it's probably just a localized collapse of the North Tower. But I remember seeing Chief Pfeiffer, and I remember filming him, giving the order about a few seconds after that, saying, everybody in Tower 1, evacuate the building. And for him, it was just a precaution because we didn't know what was... We thought the South Tower was still intact, but that the damage was in ours. And for him, it was, okay, something is wrong. Let's get everybody out.
He must have saved a lot of lives with that call. Jules Naudet, what images stay most vividly with you from the film work of that day?
The determination on the firefighter's face. That forever will stay with me. The fact that these guys, every day, every night, are on duty to specifically to do that. Not in that magnitude, no one was ever going to think it was going to happen. But basically, these firefighters are here to, whenever we have a problem, civilians, they come to our help and they're willing to risk their lives and to risk everything to be able to save us.
You've been quoted saying there was never any graphic footage shot that day, but what could be more graphic in a sense than towers on fire with thousands of people trapped inside?
I meant for that graphic footage in the terms that we never showed, we never filmed anyone dying or about to die or people were jumping. Mm-hmm. We never filmed anything like that. It was never something that we wanted to show.
And even so, there have been some protests from survivors of the 9/11 tragedy. How do you respond to those protests, Jules Naudet?
Well, I completely understand that some people are uneasy watching this, and all I can say is, you know, do not watch it. I think it's important. I remember in still now, firefighters telling us this is important. People should see what happened with the work that we did, and that's why we've been doing it as a tribute. I can tell you that.
Yes, James Hanlon, I wanted to ask you, what do you think this why do you think this documentary is important to show? What do you want people to come away from it with?
It's a tribute. It's a tribute to the firefighters. It's a tribute to the people that day and what they did. And on the darkest hours of this nation and what happened that day, people rose up and rose up above that, and they were the best of the best. And you see the people evacuating by the tens of thousands coming out. You see the firefighters, you see the policemen, the emergency service workers. You see them all doing their job and doing it well, focused and determined, and it's all captured on tape. It's very riveting. It's very captivating. Sometimes the language is strong from the men, but it's a tribute, and it's something that can't be forgotten. So many firefighters have come to me and said, "Jimmy, don't let this not be shown. It has to be shown. People have to see what happened. People cannot forget. We want the people of the United States to remember this and to remember this day."
James Hanlon is a New York City firefighter and co-producer of the CBS program 9/11. Jules Naudet is a documentary filmmaker. They spoke to us from New York. The images and emotions of 9/11 are indelibly etched in our minds and hearts, none perhaps more excruciatingly than the collapse of the Twin Towers. Now, a television special about that world-changing morning in Lower Manhattan will air Sunday night. Are you ready to revisit the horror? Is this important for memory and knowing, or is this greedy voyeurism? Do those people most affected by the tragedy have the right to ask you not to watch and learn? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me on the phone from Foxborough, Massachusetts, is Cindy McGinty. On September 11th, her husband, Mike, was in New York to attend a meeting at the Marsh McLennan headquarters on the 99th floor in the Twin Towers. Good evening and welcome, Cindy McGinty.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Cindy, we know your husband Mike lost his life that day, and we, like everybody else, share our sorrow with you for that. And I guess the first question to ask is, how are you and your children doing?
I think 6 months later, I think we're doing worse than we were in September, because I think I heard another family member say the Novocaine has worn off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the full impact of what's really happened to my family in the blink of an eye, one morning when Mike just went to work to provide for his family, is really hitting us just now. And I can't tell you how hard it is every day.
We can only imagine. You have two children. How old are they, Cindy?
I have two boys, 8 and 9.
And on that morning, you were at church when you learned that something happened.
Yeah, I was working at church, and someone's cell phone went off, and I could see him looking at me kind of funny. And she got off the phone, and she said, "Where's Mike today?" And they said he was in New York. And she said, you know, she got really upset and said that a plane had hit the building. And I thought, you know, a Cessna bumped into it. That happens. It's happened before. It's okay. Mm-hmm. And then her phone rang again a little while later, and we heard a second plane had hit, and that's when I knew it was really bad. And then we turned on the TV in church, and I watched the towers crumble.
And did you know, or when did you know that Mike was there and Mike was gone?
I knew he was there the minute when that second plane hit. I knew he was there, and when I watched the towers come down, I kept saying, "He's fine. He's going to be okay. He's level-headed." But I knew in my heart of hearts that he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was watching him die.
His body was finally recovered in October?
It was. We are one of the very, very lucky people to have Mike home with us. There's a lot of people out there who will never be able to say that, and there's no reason why I should have him home, but I do, and I'm thankful for that.
We can understand it. Cindy, that you know, of course, that day was such a personal tragedy, and you know, like all of us, at the same time, how the entire country is completely wrapped up in what happened on that day. And now, with the kind of television special we're going to see Sunday night, the conflict maybe between this personal grief and national interest, national obsession, maybe depending on your perspective, national honoring in a media sense is starting to go on. How do you feel about the events of that day being brought onto television in the way that CBS is about to bring them?
Well, I don't think that anybody has. I mean, it's a real juggling act.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a story there that needs to be told. I think there is a story there that says America stood up to terrorists and they did not win because we're still here.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, families, one of the things that the filmmaker said that really struck me was that he had the horrible image of someone on fire and he didn't want anyone else to have that image.
Right.
So he chose not to film that. Couldn't the same be said for the families watching their loved ones careen into a tower or be inside the tower and watch the towers crumbling again? My son Daniel goes to bed every night saying to me, "What do you think Daddy's last minutes were like, Mom?"
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to turn off your TV and not watch it for us is not an option because others will watch it, and I can't control what people are going to say to Daniel and David or around them. Certainly nobody would ever intentionally go up to them and say, "Hey, did you watch the CBS special?"
Mm-hmm.
But there'll be people talking about it at school the next day. There'll be teachers and adults in the hall. I can't control what other parents will let their children watch. And so that's not an option for my family. So what me and other family members have asked CBS to do is, if you're telling the story of the heroism of the firefighters that day and the policemen and any of the other public servants, what does two planes crashing into a building have to do with that?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have to watch it again? And is there really brand new footage that we haven't seen over and over again?
Well, apparently there is, but it doesn't make the question go away. Cindy McGinty, please stick with us. We have to take a short break. We're talking about the first airing of new intimate scenes from that awful, awful day when people like Cindy McGinty and her family suffered personal loss, when the nation suffered a loss. Will you be watching Sunday night? How do public access and private grief coexist in a media age? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the CBS special that will run on Sunday evening, showing new, never-before-seen footage of intimate scenes of the horror of 9/11 in Lower Manhattan, inside the World Trade Centers and the streets around the World Trade Centers. Will you be watching Sunday night? Are you ready to see and hear more detail from September 11th? Is this important understanding, or is this exploitation? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined tonight and glad, in a strange way, and honored certainly to be joined by Cindy McGinty. Her husband, Mike, died in the Twin Towers on September 11th. He was apparently at a meeting on the 99th floor. And Cindy, you were saying that you have approached CBS and asked them not to go ahead as planned. And tell us exactly what you asked and what their response was.
Well, see, the families of, I believe, the families of September 11th and families that are part of the Massachusetts 9/11 fund that has been set up have asked CBS to do a couple of things. First of all, one of the things, the only thing we really object to is the footage of the planes crashing into the building and the buildings tumbling.
Okay.
So we've asked them to pull that piece of it. Or pull the trailers that they're showing. I mean, I have a very good friend whose husband was on one of those flights who happened to be walking through the room and saw it all over again and had been in therapy trying to get rid of that image. Or postpone it till September 11th, 2002, because let's face it, everybody is going to be talking about it on that day, and everybody will be airing footage on that day, and there's going to be nowhere that we can go to escape it. And to say that, you know, it's not graphic footage, that no one is shown on camera dying, is irresponsible to me, because what do they think is happening on those airplanes and in those buildings?
Cindy, the scenes, the footage of the planes going into the building, part of that footage that we saw in the week and weeks immediately after 9/11 came actually from Jules and his brother Gideon's, the French filmmaker's video footage of that day.
Yeah.
10 seconds came from that. But people have seen that and seen it so many times, and now you're saying you don't want CBS to show that, but isn't that in a way already part of the public record, the public consciousness? What is it?
Well, I do agree. I think it's there, but why do we have to watch it again? Wasn't one time for me, I mean, I know I have a personal vested interest in it because my husband was in the building, but I have to believe that once is enough for anybody. I mean, that footage played over and over again, and, you know, my children saw that footage. And wasn't that enough for them? Do we have to bring all that back up again just as families are starting to take a tentative step out, maybe start therapy, maybe start to try and figure out, like for us, we're still trying to figure out who the McGintys are without Mike.
I'm sure
you
are.
And we're just starting to get into some semblance of what is going to be our new normal. And now this is airing one day before the six-month anniversary, and it is, I can't tell you how unbearably painful that is for me and for my family.
We can understand, and at the same time, there's a whole nation with its own interest and curiosity, and whether that's noble or not is what we want to dig into tonight. Cindy, if you'll stick with us a little bit, I want to invite into the conversation Carolyn Marvin. She's professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Good evening and welcome, Carolyn Marvin.
Hi, how are you?
We're well. Carolyn, thanks for being with us. We're trying to understand tonight how to make sense of tragedy in an information age when there are video cameras everywhere where there were, it turns out now we learned, video cameras, you know, inside the buildings on 9/11. And now that footage is coming out. I don't know if you heard at the top of the hour, but CBS is promoting it with the kind of promotion that we've all heard before. It's TV-style promotion. Cindy McGinty, who's with us on the line, lost her husband on that day. She and many others lost family members, obviously. And we're trying to make sense of where a legitimate public interest, perhaps even a kind of video homage, lies here, and where or if there's a line that shouldn't be crossed. You think about these issues a lot. Help us think about it.
Well, I think there's always such an ambiguous morality to looking. Sometimes it's very important to look and to bear witness and to enter intimately into a moment and to see something. It can be a very significant affirming moral act. And on the other hand, when the issues are very personal and painful, and we don't have the permission to look from those who are being looked at, it can seem so very aggressive and disrespectful, a kind of violation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, really, it goes even beyond that. It's even more basic than that. One way we instinctively acknowledge that something has great mystery or great power is by looking it away from it. We cast our eyes down. We establish a space between ourselves and something that is sacred. It can be a geographic space or a temporal space. And it's as though if we look at it, it could harm us, and so that's how we acknowledge its power and its mystery, because it really can hurt us to look at it. And on the other hand, perhaps even worse, we might diminish it or reduce its power or sacredness, you know, by reducing it to our level and picking it apart and debating about it. And I think that's really what the what's under the debate that's going on here.
And we all know that. It seems almost to be an instinct from ancient times, in the presence of something awesome and terrible, our eyes are cast down, and it seems appropriate. But how does that instinct coexist in a media age with the immediacy, with omnipresence of television?
Well, we can only feel the greatest sadness for the families in this. They have such a burden to bear. And at the same time, this is an event of historic proportions that has happened to all of us. And in that, it is not a single event or a single feeling or a single image or a single memory or even a single family. And it really is difficult then to say that there can only be one way to cope with it or understand it or grieve it.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, from the beginning, the images have been part of this event, and they've been part of the event for those close up and those far away.
Mm-hmm.
So this film in some way is not only a representation of the event, it is part of the event. It is a unique perspective. It is showing other reactions to the event and other parts of it.
Then why the I would agree that it is a historic event that needs to be sort of never forgotten, but the timing is the issue for the families. Why not postpone it till September 11th, 2002 if the reason for showing it is to record history, is to never forget these people? Why not hold it off till then?
Carolyn Marvin, Cindy McGinty's question as a widow of that day is, what about a decent interval here, and have we passed that interval?
Well, I think that Cindy McGinty is talking about rituals of mourning, which need to take place. There's a set of boundaries that we try and put around chaotic things to make sense of them. And I think those rituals should take place. I think they have taken place. I think they are taking place. Even the media have been part of them.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, they suspended their programming and their ads as if to say there are more important things than making money, you know.
Mm.
And I think the families have had much support and concern from strangers. I mean, this is not as though the families have been ignored in this sense.
Carolyn Marvin, let me just ask you there. This is not the first time in our national history that personal loss and national tragedy have to figure out how to sit side by side. What happened to Cindy McGinty and her family is unique in the way it happened, but in every war, the war is simultaneously a national crisis and spectacle and a personal crisis for those who lose family members. Is there something different this time, or what can history tell us about how Americans have dealt with this juxtaposition of public and private tragedy?
Oh, there have been debates before about whether or not images should be shown of sacrifice and suffering. In World War II, Life magazine, of course, occupied the place in the national consciousness in terms of distributing images to the country that the networks and television occupy now. And there was lots and lots of debate for a long time about whether bodies should be shown on the beach of American soldiers. And eventually these bodies were shown, and this was exactly the same debate. The families felt that this was a violation of their privacy. Others felt that it was very important to show that Americans actually were dying in this war. And there's also a concern about rumor as well. I mean, the holding back certain images from a sense of decorum can also be interpreted elsewhere as a handy excuse for not showing the truth. Maybe there's something to hide here that we shouldn't see.
But we have seen
Cindy McGinty?
But we have seen this. We have seen the planes crashing into the building and the mm-hmm. buildings crumbling. I'm not saying that we shouldn't show the firefighters and the bravery that they exhibited that
mm-hmm.
day.
Mm-hmm.
It's just specific portions of it. And, yes, the press and the media held back some images after the first few days, but 6 months is still so soon. Mm. Why not wait until a year when everybody's going to be showing it anyway?
Mm-hmm. Cindy McGinty, you are brave and generous to be with us tonight. Would it be all right with you if we bring some callers into this conversation?
Sure.
Margaret is on the line. Welcome, Margaret. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Margaret.
Hi. First, I'd like to say I've met Cindy at some events, and I'm just completely respectful of her opinion on this matter and her feelings. And I understand how we all have to grieve in very, very different ways.
Margaret, you have a personal connection to this day as well?
My husband was a captain of Flight 11, Tom. His airplane was the first to hit the first tower. And I feel that I want the film to be shown.
What's your thinking, Margaret?
I want to make sure that every American never loses the outrage that what has been done to our country,
mm-hmm.
how we have been ravaged. And if it takes seeing some of this footage again to keep it fresh in our minds
mm-hmm.
and to make sure that we stay on the powers that be to increase our safety, because I don't feel safe anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I want people to remember the outrage.
We can understand that, and that's been a theme in all the months throughout. But Margaret, what's your message to Cindy, for whom the freshness, making it fresh again, is pain, and as it might be for yourself, though you have different perspectives today?
As I said, I've met Cindy
mm-hmm.
At different events,
mm-hmm.
and I understand we have different ways of grieving,
mm-hmm.
and I respect her opinion, but there are differences of opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cindy McGinty, can you understand how Margaret, whose husband died on that day at the front of that plane, can have a different view?
Absolutely. I think every family grieves in its own way. I think that it is. I agree with Margaret. I hope nobody forgets how mad they should be that this happened. I hope no one ever forgets what America went through that day. I mean, if you close your eyes for a second and
mm-hmm.
you open them up,
mm-hmm.
that's what happened to my family that day. In a blink of an
mm-hmm.
eye, our lives changed forever. And
mm-hmm.
I hope everybody remembers that
mm-hmm.
forever and ever, and that my family is a changed family. But for me, you know, like Margaret said, everyone grieves in a different way. And for me, this is so painful. And I'm not saying that we should
right.
never see it. I'm just saying that the timing, for me, is
mm-hmm.
questionable.
It seems, in a sense, Cindy McGinty, that in your case, you're being asked to make another kind of sacrifice. Margaret, how, as you look out at the country, and your husband was captain of Flight 11, the first plane into the World Trade Center, do I hear concern in your voice that only 6 months later, people are forgetting the gravity of what happened on 9/11?
No, I don't think they've forgotten. But even in my own family, we tend to move on. We're doing our best. I have three children. They're 16, 14, and 11.
Mm.
They're very busy with their lives, with sports, with school. I spend a lot of time driving them around, going to meetings. We do move on, which is right and proper. We need to move on because we are still alive, as are all other Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But with any great national tragedy, as we move on, it seems to get buried behind. And this one, maybe not as much as certain other things that have happened in our country's past.
Mm-hmm.
But I think because the threat is still so real, and I worry that we haven't heard the last of the terrorists. I want people to be on guard. I want this still to be at the top of their minds. While at the same time, I want to heal. I want my children to heal.
Mm-hmm.
My friends and my family are helping us in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to move forward in my life. I don't want to wear the cloak of 9/11 my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
although I think it's right and appropriate to be wearing it right now, I just
Margaret,
don't
you
want people to forget quickly.
And Margaret brings up a really good point in that I've said this before. Mm-hmm. When somebody dies, it's and I'm not saying that's any less sad for them than what's happened to us. If somebody had a heart attack, it would mm-hmm. be just as sad for that family.
Yes.
But this is a very public grieving, and grieving is very personal.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us that lost somebody that day are being forced to do it in a very public way, sort of on the majority's time schedule and in the majority's way.
Well, that's that is exactly the price of being involved in a public, a stupendously public tragedy.
Right.
Margaret, will you be watching Sunday night?
I will.
Well, we'll be thinking of you watching, and we will not forget your loss and the captain of American Airlines Flight 11 and the whole crew on that day, all the passengers. Margaret, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, Margaret. And Cindy McGinty, before we let you go, last thoughts. Can you even imagine watching Sunday night?
No, absolutely not. And I'm not even sending my children to school on Monday. I know that I can't shelter them forever, but at least I'll give them one more day. And what I've told them is that my son Daniel is very, very smart and has already figured mm-hmm. out Monday is the 6-month anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Mom, it's the 6-month anniversary. What do we do for that? And I said, you know what? Daddy always wanted us to have fun. We're going to go do something fun that day.
Cindy McGinty, whether we watch it or not on Sunday night, our hearts and our respect are with you and with the memory of your husband, Mike McGinty. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Carolyn Marvin, there you have it, two women who dramatically lost husbands on 9/11, both dealing in very different ways with the public quality of the destruction and tragedy of that day.
Yes, I think it tells you something about the diversity of the response that's quite important. And I also think there's another issue about the kind of animal, really, that the media are. There's a way in which it's very hard for the media to take on the role of being one American community. It certainly did this for a while after 9/11
mm-hmm.
in response to the enormity of the tragedy. But the rituals of news gathering and news dissemination, information gathering and information dissemination are to be about difference and variety and distinction and elaboration. And it's hard for the media to take on the role of one community. In fact, we get nervous about some
mm-hmm.
aspects of that because
mm-hmm.
you'll remember the controversy that accompanied the fact that there was a very patriotic flavor to much of the imagery and so forth.
Carolyn, we'll talk more about it after a short break.
Okay.
We're talking about the CBS special on 9/11 coming up Sunday night. Will you be watching when the camera rolls? Is anything sacred? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
9287.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the CBS special coming up Sunday night that will bring 2 hours of mostly never-before-seen footage from inside the World Trade Center on 9/11, showing the firemen going in, the evacuees coming out, the chaos of that day, the streets outside the World Trade Center on that day. You can hear in the background in this film, you see windows being blown out of the lobby where many of us have stood in the bottom of the World Trade Center there. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, reportedly, the sound of what is like explosions and a firefighter immediately saying, "We got jumpers." People were leaping from such a height that as they touched the ground, they disintegrated. Will you be watching Sunday night? How do public access and private grief coexist in a media age? Do media reruns deepen or cheapen our understanding of 9/11? In an information age, can visual data itself be a national monument? Or is CBS a carnival barker on holy ground here? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Carolyn Marvin. She's professor of communications at the Annenberg School of Communication at University of Pennsylvania. And Carolyn Marvin, you were describing just before our break this range of responses and the fact that we've seen it before in American history.
We have, and I think the families always get caught in the crossfire here. Even today, I mean, the Skilling family probably doesn't feel too comfortable at the moment.
Jeff Skilling, Enron's former CEO.
Exactly, or the Andrea Yates family, or the family of Daniel Pearl. The Kennedy family has certainly had to endure years and years of replaying the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The Nixon family must endure the tapes recently being played of Nixon's conversations, and there's certainly lots of criticism that goes on about their father. You know, someone they're loved very much. And that really is the nature of having an open society and open media.
So it's, take us out of the private grief for a minute and to the public issue. How do you see, as a student of these things, and we've had wonderful conversations with you on this show before, but as a student of this, how does the intimate footage of the events of that day, what role does it play in the nation coming to terms with, digesting, honoring, call it what you will, what role does that play in the information age?
Well, I think it's the only way that we have to talk to each other as a community in the largest sense, and that is definitely going to mean that some people don't get to control the message in the way that they would like to and feel justified in doing. But it isn't possible for us to be, well, it is possible for us to be a single community, but we have decided with our media system that its fundamental thrust is going to be always to point out the differences and the varieties. I think that Cindy McGinty wants us to be one community and to grieve with her, and that is so understandable. And it is good to know that, you know, she has so many people that are supporting her, and that's a very good thing for her. But it just isn't in the nature of the media in some sense. Their rituals are all about not about unity and solemnity and decorum, finally, but more about showing all the differences and different perspectives that are possible. And that's always a very uncomfortable thing when people have a very personal interest.
Carolyn Marvin, stand by. We're joined now by Michael Renoff. He's professor of critical studies at the University of Southern California. He's looked deeply into documentary films and theory. Good evening and welcome, Michael Renoff.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Michael Renoff, give us a sense of historical perspective. Have there been video or film documentaries or footage in American history that have met the same kind of ambiguous reception and perhaps even rejection by an American public not ready or willing to see them?
Well, I think there are some precedents, although they're not strictly parallel. To go back to really, I guess, the radio age, I think that the Hindenburg, when the Hindenburg exploded in 1937, and there was some live radio transmission of that, and images were also made, and then a newsreel circulated shortly thereafter that put together both the sound and the image.
Was it controversial? We've heard the anguished reporting of the correspondent that day.
I think it was, but keep in mind that this was 1937, a few years before the beginning of World War II, and this was a German airship.
Right.
So that may have mitigated. I think the next, at least for American audiences, a parallel that a lot of people mentioned during the 9/11 events was, of course, Pearl Harbor. And that's another interesting historical precedent, but it's so different, again, because there were so few cameras there. One film that was made, in fact, by John Ford, a very well-known Hollywood filmmaker who was making films for the military during that period, was a film called December 7th. But it turns out that film was a more kind of memorial to the events of the day and used a lot of reenactments. Interestingly, the reenactments were then, after the fact, taken to be newsreel footage, but it contained very little newsreel footage.
And was there controversy about its release?
I don't think there was much controversy about its release. It was very carefully handled.
What about images of wartime death during World War II? Was there a lag time? Were there restrictions on what was shown at home? During Vietnam, we became very familiar with seeing, you know, gruesome detail. Was there a tradition of restraint earlier?
Well, as Carolyn Marvin said previously, there was a lot of discussion about what was acceptable in terms of showing recognizable GIs who were dead or injured. And and so I think there was a lot of care taken. There were films like The Battle of San Pietro, which was made by John Huston, another Hollywood director. Mm-hmm. And that film really steered away from doing much that would be graphic and specific to individuals. I want to mention one film, though, that was suppressed for well over 30 years, and it was also made by John Huston, and it was called Let There Be Light. It was made in 1946, and it was meant to document the recovery of American soldiers who were coming back with psychic wounds rather than physical ones. And it was really intended to help pave the way for rehabilitation and for the reintegration of the GI back into American society.
But it was too painful
it
to see?
It was too much. The War Department suppressed it, and it really wasn't publicly released until the late 1970s.
Michael Renoff, Carolyn Marvin, stand by. We have a lot of callers. Let's try and get some in. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi. What I've been rolling through my head is there's so many movies out there that are reenactments of tragic events, Vietnam and World War II and, Pearl Harbor, and so forth. But I think what it is that, this footage is like the real thing.
It's the real thing.
Mm-hmm. It's the real thing. It's not glorified. I mean, and sooner or later, I'm sure someone's going to come out with a movie called 9/11 or something, and, it's going to be reenactment.
Mm-hmm. But not Sunday night. John, it's a good point. Let me put it to our guests. This is the real thing Sunday night, though it is the filmmakers have carefully pointed out that they avoided directly filming burning bodies and the kind of most gruesome scenes. Nevertheless, it's edited. It's shaped into a two-hour television special. Michael Renoff, do you see a distinction here? There clearly is, I guess, between this is documentary footage, the real thing, and the kind of film versions that will inevitably emerge.
Oh, there's no question. The sense is with the documentary, there's a kind of implicit contract that what you're seeing when called a documentary bears some direct relationship to the lived world, to the experience of people. And, along these lines, I would say that the best parallel might well be the Space Shuttle Challenger. At that disaster of January of 1986, which was broadcast more or less live and then was replayed and always had that sense of the real and also of the immediate attached to it. Yeah, there's no question that it packs a punch and it has a kind of whammy to it because it's understood to be a part of the social world that we live in.
And in a way, if it's not ghoulish, there can be a very real interest in understanding what went on in this day. Americans like to know the facts. Carolyn Marvin, Mark Jerkowitz, the media correspondent at the Boston Globe, has called this documentary a buddy film because so much of it is about the firemen of the firehouse where the filmmakers started that day and tracking them through the events and the sacrifices and the horror and then the recongregation of that firehouse on that day. You can imagine how television will warm to that kind of theme. Is that the kind of wrapper that we need to make this palatable, or is there something even potentially, ennobling or cheapening about that kind of sentimental wrapper?
Well, it's such an awful tragedy, and people feel so helpless. A buddy film is really about guys together overcoming obstacles. So I think it's actually very valuable for people to see the heroic efforts that were made to render what assistance could be rendered.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that is a cheap thing at all. I think that's all part of the recovery process.
It's certainly,
seeing ourselves as people that can deal with it.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly a big part of the aura of heroism that has come to surround that day. Sal is on the line. Welcome, Sal. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to say right off that I do support the idea of this program being on the air.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a really tragic event that touched the lives of so many people, not just in America, but around the world,
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a part of everyone's collective memory, at least.
No question of that.
So let me just make these two points. One, I haven't heard any discussion about whether CBS will be profiting from this venture. Are they selling advertising? Are they going to be using this, our public memory here to be cloaking themselves in the glory of the, 9/11?
They will. We heard in the promo that it's sponsored by Nextel, though CBS has also said that there will be what they call limited interruption. So presumably it has sponsors, but they won't cut in as often as usual.
Right, right. I'm not thoroughly convinced. In fact, my second point is about how I'm actually pretty skeptical of CBS lately, especially with there's a show called The Agency, which has just come out.
The CIA show.
The CIA glorified. And now, you know, since when has the CIA, of all people, been heroes, you know?
Sal, we hear you, but we're going to stay on 9/11 tonight. Carolyn Marvin, let me put that to you. Does the fact that this documentary will be shared in the commercial context of American commercial television make any difference in the in your assessment of the dignity, the aura of respect around it, or is that just that's just the milieu of America?
Well, it doesn't make a difference to me because that is the kind of media system that we've decided to have. We have some non-commercial media systems, which we're participating in right here, but we've decided that's a legitimate way for media to work. I think that the filmmakers themselves are making a contribution from the film to the firemen or to
yes,
other
they
people
are.
That are
yes, they are. I should point that out. It's going to a fireman's fund.
Yeah, right. So I'm not sure that the fact that it is in a commercial context decreases its dignity.
Robert is on the line. Welcome, Robert. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just have one comment. I think it's important that this film be shown, both as a memorial and so people can see what happened. I think it's also important, though, to provide enough information to families who may not want to see it and to parents who may not want their children to see it, so that families can avoid seeing it and so that parents who don't want their children to see it can avoid having their children see it.
Robert, thanks for your comment. Michael Renoff, there's no, I guess, no mystery about what's coming here. It's being widely trumpeted by CBS. There's been a fair amount of press attention. I guess we're part of that tonight. They've been very clear in saying that they are not showing individual people dying.
Well, that's right. And this is a huge difference between if we previous contexts prior to television, because whether it was a newsreel or a film that was shown in a theater, people made a conscious choice, and they walked into a public space, and they experienced this thing. But now there's a whole different way of accessing. Televisions are in our homes, and children and other people of all sorts have access. It's really a completely different. I feel that an event like this is a little bit unprecedented in that regard.
It is the media age. Michael Renoff, professor of critical studies at University of Southern California, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Carolyn Marvin, help us take this home. Is it possible that in the new era, the electronic era, the information age, that video like this may come to be as important as marble and granite monuments in marking the nation's memory of such vast events?
I think that's been amply demonstrated in New York already. There's been just a remarkable outpouring of these kinds of improvisational, informal video pictures and photographs everywhere. And there's a tone and a kind of spirit in that kind of offering that I think can never be captured in a permanent memorial. Those are good, but that special experience of exchanging photographs and looking at photographs together, that's very important.
Well, it's what's coming. Carolyn Marvin, professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication at University of Pennsylvania, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
For more information about the 9/11 documentary we've been discussing, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.